Yeah, we're on. I think we're recording. All right. Thank you for coming, everyone. It is really, really appreciated. Hi, Margaret. I'm Bobby. I think most of you know who I am, so I won't spend too long introducing myself. But I'm a part of Jubilee Church Teesside, and I also run the ministry UK Partnerships for Christ. Up to this point, we've been a ministry kind of exclusively focusing on Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and how to reach those. And this whole event is kind of the introduction of us moving on to maybe a bit of a bigger area of Christian evangelism, which is apologetics as a whole. I won't rush to what apologetics is, because that's what I'm going to spend the next 30 or 40 minutes going through. But so this is kind of born out of an event that I've spoke at a couple of times in Manchester. There's an event in Manchester called Apologetics in Manchester. You can see what I did there. It didn't take too much thought. And they've been going for a good couple of years now, and they've been covering a whole wealth of different areas, such as why can you believe the Bible? Does God exist? What about morality? And just a real wide scope of areas. I've been a couple of times and done one on Mormonism and one on the ethics of evangelism. And so the idea of this event is we're going to go every 2 months and we're going to look at various different areas far and wide within the realm of Christianity and also within the realm of other worldviews. I'll kind of introduce at the end what the specifics are and what else we're going to be doing this year. But just the pattern is every other month. So hopefully then it's not too overbearing, but it's not so infrequent that you kind of forget about it. And the whole purpose of these sessions is it's meant to make a practical difference in your day-to-day lives, in your day-to-day witnessing with non-Christians. This isn't just about knowledge and information for knowledge and information's sake. So we can leave here thinking, isn't that good? I know something I didn't know, which may or may not happen. But the purpose of this is so that we can really, as our non-Christian friends ask us, why do you believe in God? Why are you a Christian? Why do you believe that Jesus rose from the dead? What about suffering? Which are perfectly normal day-to-day questions that we all get asked. Hopefully this will help you just to prepare for those questions and have a bit more of an answer than maybe you did before. Does that all make sense? Great stuff. So we're looking at about 30 or 40 minutes just for this session. Then we'll have a cup of tea break. And then we're just going to have a few, well, I think we'll probably break into two groups, if that's okay. And we'll have a few discussion questions up that we'll just blast through and maybe help us consider a bit more what's been said during this. All right? All right, so the question, is that still, yeah, we're doing good. The question we've all been asking since we've heard about this event, what is apologetics? So clear and simply, the word apologetics comes from the word apologia, pronounced apologia. Can we all say that? Apologia. There we go. That difficult. That's your first Greek word, or maybe not first. It means a verbal defence. So to do apologetics, to give an answer for a position that you hold on something, is just to give a verbal defence. It can, in this context, we're talking about faith, we're talking about Christianity, we're talking about Jesus. It can mean absolutely anything. It can be, why do you like that particular TV show? Why do you support that football team? Why do you this? Why do you that? Apologetics is just simply giving an answer for a position that you have on something. And so it's as simple as that. If anyone tries to make it sound more complicated than that, it's not. It's not something you have to hold a degree to do. It's just simply when someone says to you, why do you think that? It's giving an answer as to why. Not just saying, because I like it or anything like that, but it's saying, here's some good reasons as to why I hold this position. We see it in various different places in the Bible. As we said, it by no means needs to be associated with religion. In Acts 25:16, so this is about the Apostle Paul, it says, to whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die, before that which he is accused, to have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. So that's basically Paul saying, I want to give an answer for the crime that's laid against me. I want to stand in court and answer for myself. That's apologetics. Is that making sense? Great stuff. One of the very key verses that gets used again and again, so I'll get to it right from the start, in relation to apologetics is 1 Peter 3:15. And this is one I'll come back to again and again in the months to follow. And it says, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. That is apologetics. Always being ready to give an answer for the hope that is in you. There's also an element of approach there, but with gentleness and reverence. And so, because often when we come across people with different worldviews, or people, or as we go on, we're going to look at people who speak out against what we believe. You can get a bit tempted to get frustrated and get angry with these people, but it's saying, no, give an answer for the hope that you have with gentleness and reverence. That's the verse most commonly associated with apologetics, and that's one that comes back to us again and again. People at work, I know, ask me all the time, why does God allow suffering? What about all the people in other countries without food? How can you believe in the Bible? It's been changed so much over the years. So many different people wrote it. How can it be valid? Did Jesus rise from the dead? Most people would say, absolutely not. It just doesn't fit with what we see today. It doesn't fit with what people generally believe today. And when we are asked those questions, we are then to give an answer. So, and that's something to consider now as you're listening to this. Why do you believe that Jesus rose from the dead? Why do you believe that God is real? There will be answers to that, but sometimes I think when we get caught off guard, we can just kind of say, just because it feels right to me, or because it makes sense to me, or whatever. And all that's fair enough, but apologetics is all about kind of getting maybe answers that are external to yourself as to why you believe what you believe, and hopefully making Christianity that bit more reasonable to the people around you. This isn't about kind of giving the absolute proof that is going to make everyone a Christian overnight, because if there was one, we'd all use it all the time and the whole world would be Christians and it'd be dead easy. But this is just about saying to the world, this is a reasonable faith to have, and there's good reasons for me to believe what I believe. But without us having to be Bible scholars, without us having to be professors, you're all of that type of thing. Here's another verse that is quite key. Oh, here we go. What apologetics does not do. A lot of people can, particularly those engaged in apologetics, can maybe make the mistake of thinking that all you need to do is give a load of great answers and that's going to bring people to Christ. But we kind of see a formula in the Bible as to how people do actually come to faith. Romans 1:16 says, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." And John 6:44, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day." When someone comes to Christ, it's not just because somebody laid out a good argument. It's because God has drawn them. It's because something has gone on between them and God. Apologetics does not replace that. It just brings people to a place where they'd be more open to hearing the message. Does that make sense? So what apologetics does not do is it does not save people. It does not replace evangelism. It does not replace just stating the gospel. But it prepares people's hearts for that time when that's going to come, and hopefully breaks down some barriers that might stop people being open to the Christian message. Just moving on. There we go. There is good evidence for faith. As Christians, that'll make sense in a minute. As Christians, we have nothing to fear in looking into external evidences to support our faith. That doesn't mean that everyone out there agrees with us, but it does mean that if Christianity is true, there should be no shortage of things out there kind of giving some indication that Christianity is true. We shouldn't be afraid of what else is out there as we look into the background of our faith. A guy that I know from Facebook, that's this guy up here, called Peter Byram. He was a former atheist that came to Christ because of coming into contact with apologetics. Here is some of his story. He says, "I came from a religious background. My parents are Christian, but that Christian upbringing, whatever faith you might say that I had at the time, that didn't survive leaving my parents' authority and going away to university. It was sincere doubts, but also slightly less sincere desires. The two played off each other. The new atheism and the Richard Dawkins books were perfect for that because they played up to both, showing that atheism looked more attractive, but also that it was more intellectually credible so that they were persuasive." This whole thing of new atheism is that there's a massive uprising in the country and beyond of atheists who are actively seeking to speak out against Christianity and draw people away from Christianity. There's a book I bought which I haven't read yet, and it's called How to Make People into Atheists. It's basically a book that an atheist has wrote instructing other atheists how to make Christians into atheists. And so there's a massive uprising of almost evangelism out there within atheism of people trying to draw Christians out into what they call reasonableness. Going on with Peter's story, he said, what struck with me the most from Richard Dawkins was that he defined faith as believing something without evidence or in the face of evidence. He would always be saying that you need to base your beliefs on things that have good evidence, a good reason for them. So, of course, I completely agreed with that. That sounds reasonable. Looking through YouTube, that was when I stumbled across William Lane Craig. So he's a very well-known Christian apologist, and his debates and his talks. And that was very different. Something struck me about that as being very unusual, because here was a Christian academic who was actually talking very precisely, very logical, and making his case from the ground up, appealing to the very reason and evidence that Dawkins was telling me I had to take seriously and to look for. I ended up having a look for myself and actually realised that there was good evidence for Christianity. So why haven't you become one yet? I was trying to hold out in living a certain way. I was running away from it, and that was silly. Frankly, that was very silly to keep running away. It was not about following a load of religious rules or anything like that. It's about coming to the faith, coming back to the relationship with God that we were supposed to have in the way that a child who was run away from home can be reconciled with their parents. For example, really, that was the realisation. Just come home to it. Stop running away. It is silly, and you've no reason to run away, and you've every good reason to come back. So this is someone who was totally kind of caught up with atheism, with Richard Dawkins, with this whole idea that it's reasonable to doubt God, it's reasonable to walk away from all things faith. But he saw in listening to just the works of a Christian apologist that it really was actually not as simple as those guys might make out. Christianity is not where you go when you lose interest in evidence. It is about loving God with our mind as well as our emotions. And so we all on a regular basis will worship God, pray to God, really kind of engage with God on a personal level. And that's certainly the most significant way to do it. But also in loving God with our minds, that means truly getting to know him, truly what he's said to us in his word, truly engaging intellectually with Christianity. And as we love God with our mind and our heart, I think apologetics kind of develops us in that way. A really good quote I heard was, "Faith is not belief held in the absence of evidence, but rather a commitment to what one already believes when an insatiable appetite for more evidence is unmet." Does that make sense? So faith is not belief held in the absence of evidence, but rather a commitment to what one already believes when an insatiable appetite for more evidence is unmet. So this event, this apologetics in Teesside, because what I'm going to do today, I'm not going to be giving you these evidences for Christianity. This is kind of an introduction to the whole area of apologetics. But as we go on in the months to come, we're going to be looking at who is Christ. We're going to be looking at, is the Bible reliable? Did Jesus rise from the dead? All those areas that people might criticise our faith on, we're going to look at in a bit more depth and to actually see that there is good evidence and good reason to believe those things. The Christian apologist William Lane Craig, who we mentioned earlier, said this. He said, "As Christians, we face two tasks in our evangelism, saving the soul and saving the mind. That is to say, not only converting people spiritually, but converting them intellectually as well. And the church is lagging dangerously behind with regard to this second task. If the church loses the intellectual battle in one generation, then evangelism will come immeasurably more difficult in the next. The war is not yet lost, and it is one which we must not lose. Souls of men and women hang in the balance. For the sake of greater effectiveness in witnessing to Jesus Christ himself, as well as for their own sakes, evangelicals cannot afford to keep living on in the periphery of responsible intellectual existence. Thinking about your faith is indeed a virtue, for it helps you to understand and defend your faith, but thinking about your faith is not the equivalent to doubting your faith." And so the quote in that really kind of stuck with me was, if the church loses the intellectual battle in one generation, then evangelism will become immeasurably more difficult in the next. And I think in our society today, we see a massive rise of the whole postmodernism, of the denial of truth altogether. There's one quote I really like that says, in the 60s, people got offended when you said Christianity was true. Today, they get offended if you say anything is true. And I think today, there's just a massive denial of truth at all. And I think we are possibly seeing the after effects of that shift in the intellectual culture over the years. So the question is, who is influencing our non-Christian friends and family today? Yeah, so someone is my point, but the media, which is definitely where this is going to go in a sec, is a massive one. What the media is saying about Christianity, what the media is saying about faith, is what people are hearing. And usually it's from someone that looks and sounds quite clever or quite well known. And so therefore, quite often, people will just take that on face value. I think very recently, there's been three main areas that have, people kind of challenging, not yet, people challenging the Christian truth claims, and this is one of the key ones. Some of you may have seen this when it was on. Now, and some of you may not. But I'll just play this out to you and then I'll explain it.
Suppose what Oscar believed in as he died, in spite of your protestations, suppose it's all true, and you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically, what's known as theodicy, I think, I'll say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I would say.
And you think you're going to get in
on
that?
No, but I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to get in on his terms. They're wrong. Now, if I died and it was Pluto, Hades, and if it was the 12 Greek gods, then I would have more truck with it, because the Greeks were... They didn't pretend not to be human in their appetites and in their capriciousness and in their unreasonableness. They didn't present themselves as being all-seeing, all-wise, all-kind, all-beneficent. Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac. Utter maniac. Totally selfish. Totally. We have to spend our life on our knees thanking him? What kind of God would do that? Yes, the world is very splendid, but it also has in it insects whose whole life cycle is to burrow into the eyes of children and make them blind. They eat outwards from the eyes. Why? Why did you do that to us? You could easily have made a creation in which that didn't exist. It is simply not acceptable. So, you know, atheism is not just about not believing there's a God, but on the assumption that there is one. What kind of God is he? It's perfectly apparent that he is monstrous, utterly monstrous, and deserves no respect whatsoever. The moment you banish him, your life becomes simpler, purer, cleaner, more worth living, in my opinion.
That sure is the longest answer to that question that I ever got in this entire series.
There, he didn't hold back, did he? Go on, John. I don't know. I should have checked that, but I don't know. So as of this morning on YouTube, that's had 5,664,842 views. And chances are there's other places on YouTube and the internet where that is as well. So I can think it would go well beyond that. There's a lot of Christian responses to that that's out there on the internet, so I'm not going to give you them now. Feel free to have a look around. But that's what people are hearing. That's what's influencing people. That's what your non-Christian you sit next to at work when they're flicking around the telly is seeing and thinking, yeah, that makes sense. And so there's another one as well. I don't know if any of you read. Yeah, we're still working. Yep, that's okay. We're fine. Newsweek magazine did... an article on the Bible just before Christmas. They said this: the Bible is not the book that many American fundamentalists and political opportunists think it is, or more precisely what they want it to be. Their lack of knowledge about the Bible is well established. A Pew Research poll in 2010 found that evangelicals ranked only a smidgen higher than atheists in familiarity with the New Testament and Jesus' teachings. Americans revere the Bible, but by and large they don't read it, wrote George Gallup Jr. and Jim Castelli, pollsters and researchers whose work focused on religion in the United States. The Barna Group, a Christian polling firm, found in 2012 that evangelicals accepted the attitudes and beliefs of the Pharisees, the religious leaders depicted throughout the New Testament, and as opposing Christ and his message more than they accepted the teachings of Jesus. And again, that's a very big, widespread current affairs magazine that's published over here, over there. And sometimes, I mean, that study that was done that found Christians often don't have knowledge in the Bible more than atheists, that's probably a genuine study that's genuinely been done in discussion with Christians. There's genuine challenges there, but then where that takes that is the area that we as Christians need to respond to. Well, yeah, to say that someone goes to church doesn't necessarily mean they're a Christian, and I think America still has a lot of the culture that where people identify themselves as Christians even when they don't necessarily believe in Jesus. I think we've moved on past that now, where if you say you're a Christian, you tend to be, whereas they still have that. So that's a fair point. Finally, some of you might have seen this recently. This is everyone's favourite American president.
see faith driving us to do right. But we also see faith being twisted and distorted, used as a wedge, or worse, sometimes used as a weapon. From a school in Pakistan to the streets of Paris, we have seen violence and terror perpetrated by those who profess to stand up for faith, their faith. Profess to stand up for Islam, but in fact are betraying it. We see ISIL, a brutal, vicious death cult that, in the name of religion, carries out unspeakable acts of barbarism, terrorizing religious minorities like the Yazidis, subjecting women to rape as a weapon of war, and claiming the mantle of religious authority for such actions. We see sectarian war in the murder of Muslims and Christians in Nigeria, religious war in the Central African Republic, a rising tide of anti-Semitism and hate crimes in Europe, so often perpetrated in the name of religion. So how do we, as people of faith, reconcile these realities? The profound good, the strength, the tenacity, the compassion and love that can flow from all of our faiths, operating alongside those who seek to hijack religious for their own murderous ends. Humanity has been grappling with these questions throughout human history. And lest we get on our high horse and think this is unique to some other place, remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ. In our home country, slavery and Jim Crow all too often was justified in the name of Christ. Michelle and I returned from India, an incredible, beautiful country, full of this magnificent diversity, but a place where in past years religious faiths of all types have, on occasion, been targeted by other peoples of faith simply due to their heritage and their beliefs. Acts of intolerance that would have shocked Gandhiji, the person who helped to liberate that nation. So this is not unique to one group or one religion. There is a tendency in us, a sinful tendency, that can pervert and distort our faith. In today's world, when hate groups have their own Twitter accounts and bigotry can fester and hidden places in cyberspace, it can be even harder to counteract such intolerance. But God compels us to try. And in this mission, I believe there are a few principles that can guide us, particularly those of us who profess to believe.
So that's I think that's literally in the last week, that's at a Christian prayer breakfast that Obama was speaking at, and he's basically saying, look guys, lest you speak out against the Islamic terrorism that's going on, you Christians were just as bad a number of years ago. And again, on face value, people might hear that and think, fair enough. But I mean, this is something I saw someone put on Facebook, which I thought was quite good, looking at the different extents as to what's gone on with both of those different things. People hear these things on face value and think, oh, well, the Christians are just as bad then. And that further, you know, promotes any intolerance of Christians. Whereas in reality, when you look under the surface and look at the history, you find that there is a significant difference as to what's going on now and what's gone on in the past. Whereas, again, the media just throws out blanket statements of Christians don't know the Bible, God's a horrible maniac, the Christians were just as bad as the Muslims now, and then that just creates a barrier between them and Christianity, even if they don't know whether there's any substance to those claims or not. And so apologetics is just all about responding to those things and just saying, look, maybe it's not quite as simple as what Obama said. Here's a book you can read, here's an article you can read, here's what I found when I did some research. And it's just kind of breaking down some of those barriers and helping people to see that it's not as simple as sometimes the media can make out. Go ahead, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and that's an entirely fair point, yeah. Mm. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a good point you raise. I mean, the reality is, like it or not, there has been plenty done bad in the name of Christianity, in the name of Christ, by Christians or so-called Christians over the years. That doesn't validate or invalidate Christianity. Christianity is validated by the, you know, the reality of it, if you know what I mean. But it's just all about the barriers that it creates of belief between those that are not Christians to become Christians because of these misconceptions or because of these misrepresentations of Christianity that's been done over the years. But you're absolutely right, that's not where the substance lies, if you know what I mean. So that's kind of an overview of just what apologetics is. Just to kind of take this on a bit, we're just going to look at what is the goal of apologetics. Scratch sheet up. There it is. So the goal of apologetics is to show Christianity to be a reasonable faith. As I said earlier, apologetics is not about showing absolutely black and white, without the shadow of a doubt, Christianity is true. Because I think if that's what apologetics was, there'd be a bit more pressure than maybe any of us would feel like, you know, feel ready to do. If you can only present to someone an argument for Christianity, if you've got the most watertight, well-rounded, well-studied, well-thought-out argument that anyone's ever known, you probably wouldn't do it. And so what apologetics is about is it's just about showing to the people around you that this is a reasonable worldview to have. That to become a Christian doesn't mean you switch your brain off. It doesn't mean that you're kind of totally out of step with reality. It's actually just acting on the basis of what good solid evidence there is out there. A question many may ask is, does apologetics seek to replace the simple proclamation of the gospel? And the answer is very simply no. It's just a way of preparing people's hearts to hear the gospel. People over the years might have lost a loved one at a very unexpected time, and they might think that God allowed that, so therefore I don't have any interest in God. And then just dealing with the question of why does God allow suffering can just help people see the kind of context of things and maybe put them in the place where they will go to your Alpha course, or they will come to your church, or they will hear more about what you believe. So moving this on, what are the different types of apologetics? For many of us, this isn't a big deal. We are just going to kind of go about it in our day-to-day way. We're going to look things up and explain it to people. But for people who are maybe a bit more interested in getting into this further, this is quite interesting to know. There's what we might call defensive apologetics and offensive apologetics. I'll just explain what that means. Defensive is very simple, and this is what most of us are going to do. It's just responding to questions. If someone at work says to you, what about that? And you either having the answer or you going and looking it up and then bringing the answer to them. That's defensive apologetics. It can also be responding to public challenges to the Christian faith. What can sometimes be quite an interesting thing to do is you could say to your non-Christian friends, did you see that Stephen Fry thing the other day? You bring it to them. And then they might say yes, they might say no. And then you actually bring them what you think of it right from the start. And that can be a very interesting way of actually using these things to our advantage by bringing them up to them and then communicating what we actually think about as Christians as a result. Too often these things might be brought up by the atheist first as some kind of a trump card, but if we just go straight to it and say, did you see that Barack Obama thing the other day? Just, you know, let's talk about that a bit more, and that can be quite useful. That's quite simple. There's then offensive apologetics, and what I've done over the years in my outreach to be offensive doesn't mean to be offensive, by the way, I'll explain that. It doesn't mean you go up to people and swear at them and then tell them about Jesus' story. It just means being proactive in your witness. So over the years, what I've done with Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, you might call proactive, in standing outside of Mormon events, as we're going to do in Utah and June Lee. So there's a few different things here. It means proactively speaking out against other worldviews. And so a big thing that's going on today is obviously Islam. Well, that's been going on a long time, but certainly it's a big thing in the media. So that can be quite a helpful area sometimes as Christians to have an understanding of. And we are going to do a session on Islam this year. Bringing a Christian perspective on current events. Again, before someone says to you, why does God allow that? Just saying to someone, you know, here's what I think of that. And that can, again, surprise people that Christians have a response to that. And this one will sound a bit strange. I'll explain this. Showing the reality of the absurdity of life without God. And so that sounds a bit grand, and I will explain it. But basically, for someone to live without God means that they're living without any kind of objective morality. They're living without any kind of specific purpose. They're just an organism that is born, dies, and moves on. And that can seem quite a harsh way of putting it, but when you truly think about the difference between living with God, living with the purpose that he brings, and living aside from that, we are just animals waiting for death. Does that make sense? And this is a brilliant letter that someone wrote to William Lane Craig, and this will bring this home to you a bit more. The headline is, "You've ruined my life, Professor Craig." And this is excellent. I'll just read this out to you. It's a bit long, but it's good. "Dear Professor Craig, my name is Adam. I'm an atheist and have been one ever since I can remember. I was brought up in the Roman Catholic Church, but could never really say that I had any theistic beliefs with any sincerity. For instance, one time when I was around 8 or 9 years old, I asked a nun at my church where I was before I was born. She responded, 'You were with God.' I was still curious, so I asked her for how long I was with God before my being born, and she proclaimed, 'For an eternity.' Sounds more Mormon than Christian, this, but I wouldn't mind a chat with that nun, but anyway. I then asked her why I could not remember existing with God for an eternity of time. Is an eternity of time even a coherent concept? She had enough with that question and proceeded to shoo me away to play with the other children. Looking back, I'm proud of my sceptical disposition. Let's skip ahead a little bit. I found philosophy and I fell in love with it. I transferred schools in order to obtain my BA. Almost all of the papers I wrote as an undergrad were about atheism or God. I went on a mission to be as rational as I could with regards to my atheistic beliefs. Moreover, I was practically an evangelical atheist." So this is kind of something I've mentioned already. "Proclaiming the good word of rationality. My beliefs were strident at best and intolerant at worst. I thought I had the God question all figured out. It was a settled issue for me. God did not exist. The philosophy of religion was my initial and main draw to philosophy. But I soon found myself wanting to explore philosophy in all its glory. Philosophy as a whole was just too interesting to stop and then move on to some real job. I decided to apply to an MA program in philosophy at my university and got accepted. Philosophy was something that I took very seriously, so much so that I drove from New York to California with no job and no place to live in order to continue my studies. I actually wrote a response to your paper, The Absurdity of Life Without God," so this is the point that we're going to, "and used it as my writing example in order to get into university. I stayed up for months writing and polishing my responses to your claims of the inconsistency of atheism and its response to meaning, value and purpose in life. I had to. You were telling me my life, as a direct result of my worldview, was worthless in every possible way. Well, as an ambitious philosophy student, I could not simply let you get away with this. Your objections to atheism needed answers. And after wrestling with your paper for some time, I actually felt pretty good about the end product and presumed to have answered your objections to atheism in a satisfactory way. I could now move on, live my life with the excitement, consistency, and appreciation that I had before reading your essay. I was wrong. I should have known better too. Since the first time I read that paper of yours, I couldn't sleep for 2 days. It completely shattered my worldview. Let me mention here that I was a huge fan of the New Atheists, but I always sensed something was askew with them. Something seemed off about them, because when they were talking about meaning, value or purpose, they answered in such ways that only a person ignorant of the objections in your paper could respond. In short, too late, your paper never left my mind. Even years after I wrote a response to it, I knew deep down that not only did I not, but I could not answer your objections to atheism. What you say the atheist worldview entails is true. There is no escaping the nihilism as an atheist. And nihilism is the worldview that nothing matters, nothing has any value. It doesn't matter what you do because nothing has a consequence, nothing has any significance. And that is ultimately what William Lane Craig argued atheism is. Everything has died for me. You have ruined my life. So last bit. Now let's get down to business and why exactly you have ruined my life. After reading your paper on the absurdity of life without God, I soon realised that I had to become a nihilist. To act otherwise would simply be to reduce into an inconsistency. Nihilism is the logical conclusion of an atheistic worldview. Yet nihilism is unlivable. Christopher Hitchens, who is a very well-known outspoken atheist who's died now, used to say that you cannot derive any knowledge of what atheists believe from the fact that she is an atheist. If someone claims to be an atheist, according to Hitchens, you can only conclude that she believes that God does not exist, or that she lacks a belief in God. Don't get me started with that distinction. You cannot go any further and know if she is a Marxist or a capitalist, etc. But your paper shows that Hitchens is patently false about this. Atheism necessarily entails nihilistic conclusions about certain questions, particularly those you bring up in your paper about meaning, value, and purpose. Does that make sense? So that's it doesn't say that person became a Christian that I'm aware of, though they're certainly on the way, but it just showed that they kind of saw barefaced what their worldview stands for, what their worldview really means of an existence without God. And that's quite a harsh thing to bring to people. If you sat next to your friend at work having lunch and said, you realise your life's totally purposeless without God, that might be a bit blunt, but it is definitely a whole area that you can gradually kind of show people and feed to people and say, what about objective morality? One of the sessions I want to do with this event in the months to come is looking at the moral argument for the existence of God. And what that simply means is, if there is no God, there is no real such thing as morality. Morality is just something that changes with society over time. So 50 years ago, society didn't accept homosexuality. So you could say at that time it was morally wrong. Today, it accepts it. So therefore, it's morally right. In 50 years' time, who knows what else they might be accepting, and then therefore that will become morally right. Without belief in God, without belief in a God that states what is right and what is wrong, there is no such thing as objective, meaning outside of ourselves, right and wrong. Does that make sense? That's something we'll dig into a bit more in a future event, but that's kind of around this whole area, which is a real fascinating place to go with non-Christians if you're kind of prepared for it. So that's essentially offensive apologetics, and that's just basically being proactive to bring these things to people before they even ask you questions about them. So, last bit on different... Is this working? Yep, still there. Types of apologetics. So, again, this gets a tiny bit more wordy, but we'll move on to something else after this. And this is just basically five different types of apologetics that have been identified. And some of us might find that some naturally appeal to our thought process a bit more, or some might not work with us at all, and that's absolutely fine. There's the classical method, the evidential method, the cumulative case method, the presuppositional method, and the reformed epistemology method. I'll explain that one when we get there. I'm sure that all makes perfect sense. So the classical method, just to blast through that, and that the likes of William Lane Craig subscribes to this, that aims to establish theism, which is just a belief in God, through arguments from nature, then to present evidences to prove that Christianity is the correct version of theism. Most proponents of this method claim there is no point to presenting arguments from the simple answer to this is no. Oh, no, totally gone somewhere else there. There is no point in presenting arguments from historical evidence until the person has embraced a theistic worldview, as they will always interpret them based on their old worldview. The evidential method. This uses both historical and philosophical arguments, but focuses primarily on the historical and other evidence for the truth of Christianity. It will argue at the same time both for theism and in general for Christianity in particular. Because if you convince someone that God's real, you've still got to then bring them to Christ, if you know what I mean. You don't want to convince someone to become a Muslim. Don't do that. Cumulative case method. Rather than approaching the task as a formal logical argument, this sees the case for Christianity as more like the brief a lawyer makes in a law court. An informal argument drawing together evidence that together makes a compelling case with which no other hypothesis can compete. And I think that's a type of line we might go down a little bit for the resurrection one next time. But there's a couple of books out there by guys who are ex-lawyers in America who wrote books called The Case for Christianity and things like that, which are really good because they really go right through all the different reasons why you would stand in court and say Christianity is true. The presuppositional method. Don't worry if you don't remember all these, that's no big deal, but it just emphasises the noetic effects of sin to the degree that believers and unbelievers will not share through common ground for the preceding three methods to accomplish their goal. The apologist must presuppose the truth of Christianity as the proper starting point for apologetics. All experience is interpreted and all truth known through the Christian revelation and scriptures. That's basically saying when you communicate with a non-Christian, you're not trying to convince them that Christianity is true. You're starting from the basis of that being the case and then just working from there. And finally, the reformed epistemology method. For all of you, the one of you that's wondering what epistemology is, that's just how you come to know what you know. It's a philosophical term. You know that I'm stood here because you can see me. It's one that comes up a lot with Mormons because they say, I know that the church is true because they have had an internal witness. Their epistemology is feelings-based. So that's all that word means. This argues that people believe many things without evidence and that this is perfectly reasonable. Although positive arguments in defence of Christianity are not necessarily wrong, belief in God does not need the support of evidence or arguments to be rational. The focus, therefore, tends to be more on negative apologetics, defending against challenges to theistic belief. So that's just a few different styles and different approaches to apologetics. For some of us, we'll never look at them again. For some of us who get maybe a bit more into this, that might make more sense. There's also some different objections to apologetics that Christians can bring. Some Christians, and I think some of these actually have some validity when you look at them, but it's just a case of understanding, again, what apologetics really is. Some people say you can't argue people into the kingdom. And that goes back to what we were saying earlier, that apologetics does not replace evangelism. It just prepares people to be in a place when they might come to God. So thoughts behind this are people respond to God, not clever arguments, which is absolutely right in the ultimate sense. John 6:44 says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day." There's nothing there of saying you need to flush them with loads of great arguments and then they'll come to me. It just says the Father will draw him. However, as we've seen, there can sometimes be barriers that need to be removed before people make that step. In Acts, we see how the Apostle Paul went from town to town preaching to people. And it says this in Acts 18:4. It says, "And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks." So what Paul did in every town that he went straight to the synagogue, he went straight to the marketplace, he went to the kind of epicentre of the culture, the epicentre of faith, and then he tried to reason with people from the scriptures, as many different verses say. He presented arguments to people as to why they should come to Christ. And we'll look at Paul a little bit more in a minute. God does not need defending, which is absolutely true, but for those of you who've seen this event on Facebook, I love the other side to this, but people need help understanding. When we are doing apologetics, we're not defending God, we're not answering for God, we're not trying to make God sound nicer than he is. We're just explaining to people who God is and why they should come to know him. We aren't kind of standing for God as if he's sat in the corner hoping that we'll make him okay for people, but we're just helping people understand. And number three, don't over-intellectualise your faith. And that is a danger for people who get caught up in apologetics too much. You can focus so much on the intellectual side that you miss the relational side with God. So that's a genuine thing to be aware of in apologetics. So as with all these different things, they have some validity, but it's a case of seeing apologetics in the context of what it is and not letting it be something that it shouldn't be. Does that make sense? Great stuff. We're well on the way. So moving towards the end, is there apologetics in the Bible? And this is quite a key question, because if there isn't, then maybe we shouldn't be doing it. And so there's a very key case, which I'm going to kind of go through with you now, in Acts 17. Greg Forster, the author of Joy for the World, How Christianity Lost Its Cultural Influence and Can Begin Rebuilding It, said this. He said, Acts 17 records Paul's famous visit to Athens, the academic centre of the Roman Empire of the day. One commenter likened the intellectual power of Athens at the time to all the Ivy League schools, as well as Oxford and Cambridge universities, all rolled into one. Though Paul was repulsed by the idolatry that he saw there, he did not turn away from the city in disgust. Instead, he plunged into the marketplace, so he went right into the centre of the culture, the agora, where we are told he daily reasoned with those that he found there about the gospel. Now, when you and I think of a marketplace, we think of a shopping and retail. Of course, the agoras of ancient cities are contained that, but they were much more. The agora was the media centre, the only place to learn the news at a time, before the newspapers and other technological media. It was also the financial centre where investors connected with businesses. It was the art centre as well, the place where so much art was performed, and it was the place where the new political and philosophical ideas were debated. In short, the agora was the cultural centre of any city. And since this was Athens, which along with Rome was the most influential of all, had the most influence of all cities, it could be said to be part of the cultural centre of the Greco-Roman world. The ideas forged and accepted here flowed out and shaped the way the rest of society thought and lived. And so we see there that where Paul goes in Acts 17, and I'm just going to read that passage to you at the minute, he wasn't hiding from society, he wasn't hiding from the kind of the media, from the central place. He went right into the centre of it with the gospel. So I'm just going to read Acts 17, 16 to 34 to you. And this is kind of an apologetic model that we see in the Bible. "Now when Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. So he went straight into the cultural centre of the city. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him and said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" It sounds like what some people might say about Christians today. Others said he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to Areopagus. That's the right way of putting that. Saying, "May we know what this teaching is, new teaching is that you're presenting. For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So it was almost a little bit of a postmodern society like what we see today. People were constantly waiting to hear new ideas and to explore these new ideas. So Paul addresses them. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, says, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are religious." So he looks around at him, sees what they are, and just directly engages with it. "For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.'" Paul acknowledges their worldview before he then gets started with responding to it. "What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is not far from each of us, for in him we live and we move and we have our being. As even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." So there's a brilliant model for apologetics there. Paul looks at their society, looks at their culture, looks at their worldview. And before he gets started with, "You all need to follow Jesus, you know," he says, "I can see that this is what you are. I can see this is what you follow. Let me kind of show what I have to say to you relates to that." And it's fascinating as well. He actually quotes one of their own poets. That's like speaking to an atheist and quoting Dawkins. And so sometimes when you're talking to atheists about the lack of morality, there's some brilliant quotes from Dawkins where he fully agrees with Christians that there is no morality within atheism. So it's powerful just to say, "Do you realise that Dawkins says this? Let's talk about that." And so what Paul's doing there, he quotes one of their very own poets, says, "Look at what they say. That fits in with what I'm saying here. Would you like to hear some more?" And I think that's an excellent model for apologetics. So, and then this goes on. It says, "Being then," let me just make sure I'm at the right place. Yep. "Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold, silver, or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent." So then he gets into the gospel message. "Because he had fixed the day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising them from the dead." So at that point, he's engaged with their worldview. He said, "I can see where you're coming from. This is what your people have said. You need to repent." And then it goes on. "Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, 'We will hear you again about this.' So Paul went out from their midst, but some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius and the Areopagite," I should have looked at the pronunciations before I did this, "and a woman named Damaris," that's better, "and others with them." So there's three responses to Paul there. Yeah, great. We see mocking, and that's okay, that happens. We see people actually coming to Christ as a response to what he said, and we also see here some people desiring to hear more. And I think that's the main thing I kind of see from the apologetic thrust of what Paul did there. He engages with their worldview, he quotes even one of their own people, he then speaks to that worldview, and then he calls them to repentance. And as a result, he gets mocking, salvation, and the desire to hear more. And that is an excellent response to what we would seek to bring to people, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense? So we see that apologetic model in the Bible. So moving this on, who is doing apologetics? There's a lot of different really good resources out there. We are going to be meeting every other month, but there's things out there on the internet that you can look at and kind of learn a bit more from in the meantime. Probably the main thing on there that I would recommend, they're just a few different Christian organisations that do apologetics. If you may already know of some yourself, and I'm sure they're great. But the top left there's a radio show called Unbelievable. Some of you might have heard of that. It's on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday afternoon. It's probably on about now. And that's where a guy called Justin Briley, he usually brings on a non-Christian and a Christian picks a subject and then just has them dialogue with each other for about an hour and a quarter, something like that. That is really, really good. That's well worth looking at on the internet. It's on every single week. John likes it. And it's very good. They even had me on there once. So that's not why it's really good. So we're getting towards the end here. Why should you do apologetics? And so what I mean by doing apologetics isn't making a big ministry out of it, but why should you come to these events? Why should you look into this stuff a bit more in between them? Why should you consider all of this stuff? And here's just four reasons that I came up with. To protect yourself from deception. So what it means to do apologetics, it doesn't just mean reading books by big scholars and learning how to explain to people why God is real. It means just really understanding the theology of what you believe. It means being able to explain to someone why you think Jesus is God. It means being able to explain to someone the Trinity. And so all that simply means is just reading your Bible and coming to a good understanding of it. I visited quite a few Jehovah's Witness meetings over the years. I'm sure none of you are going to become Jehovah's Witnesses. But as I was going around and speaking to them, you'd kind of say to them, how did you become a witness? And the stories were remarkably similar every time. I used to go to a local C of E. I used to go to a local Methodist. I had a load of questions, but my vicar or pastor couldn't answer them for me. I had a knock on the door of a Jehovah's Witness one day, and they had all the answers, so I became one. And I think in kind of really understanding our own theology and really understanding what we believe, we protect ourselves against falsehood. And the likes of Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons, we'll probably all agree, are quite clearly false. But there's a lot of things going on within Christianity that is problematic. There's a rise of the views of universalism. There's a rise of the views of lots of different things right from within Christianity, of people saying those things that Christians have said for years, that's not right, I think this. And even you might find at church sometimes someone might present a different view to you that, you know, sounds a bit wrong, sounds a bit right. But if you truly understand where you are coming from, that protects you against just falling for the next kind of big thing, if you know what I mean. So it builds your confidence in your faith and the reasons that it's true. If nothing else, it does that for you. It shows to the world that there are good reasons to believe Christianity. As your friend asks you why you believe what you believe, and you give them a good quality answer, that shows them, actually, well, I wasn't expecting that. I just thought they were going to say, because my mum was one, or whatever. And so in giving an answer for the hope that we have, it just sends a different message to the world about Christianity. It breaks the stereotype that Christians do not have answers to questions. So many people out there just think of Christians as these, you know, stupid people who just believe everything that everyone tells them and they've got no real reason to think it. And just engaging in this stuff just really changes that worldview to the people around you. Does that make sense? Right, we're on to the last slide. This one takes half an hour now, Monica. Right. Actually, no, it's not. It's the second last. But this, more or less. Where do we go from here? So the purpose, as I said right at the beginning of this, is not just to feed you with information so you can go away feeling informed. It's so that we can actually be prepared to give an answer for the people around us so that we can be better in our witness, better prepared in our witness to non-Christians. That's completely the purpose of this. It's just evangelism. It's not egghead theologians or anything like that. One question I would ask you guys is if you have specific areas that you would like to see covered in this event, if there's one question you keep getting asked that you don't know the answer to, if there's one area that you've always thought, I wonder what that's all about, if it fits in with this, then we could definitely fit that in at some point. You don't have to say it today, but that's just something to consider. And we have a number of future events coming up. And this is them. There's some little white cards there that you're all welcome to take. And please take some for others. That just has this list on it. And there's also some red flyers that we've put together for this event. Again, feel free to take some and pass them on. But for this year, we're going to be meeting here every time, all being well. 2 o'clock till, I've put 2 o'clock till four, but it'll be 2 o'clock till between half three and four. It's just so you don't come here and, you know, come longer than you expected. We'll probably be done just after half three today. So we're going to be looking at Easter weekend at Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? We're going to be looking at Is the Bible Reliable? Looking at Islam. We're hopefully going to get someone in who used to be a Muslim to do that. And we're going to spend two sessions at the end of the year looking at who is Jesus, looking at the doctrine of Christ. And that's really useful for when we come across groups like the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and others like them as well. Sorry? So that's that. Is there any questions on that? Oh, I explained it perfectly. No, I'm sure I didn't. You're just all struggling to be aware. What we're going to do now.